This episode of Stemetz Say What is brought to you by Akamai. Akamai is the world's largest distributed edge compute platform to deliver and protect your digital experiences worldwide. Tap into Akamai for its unrivaled intelligence, performance, and scalability. Follow us on Instagram at Akamai Careers. That's AKAMAI Careers. I'm Anne-Marie Maffedon, CEO and head Stemet at Stemetz.
And I'm Carla Rosario, and this is Stemetz Say What. Say What.
In each episode, and this is the last of the first set of 12, we have met a different expert to discuss what it's really like to break into the fields of STEM and STEAM.
So there's so many people around me now that did not necessarily go to university, and they have access to crazy 3D softwares, you know, that allows them to do VFX the same way Marvel does, but they do it from their bedroom.
This week's guest is designer and creative technologist Maria Than.
We'll discuss AI, NFTs, lots of letters, and what else the future holds for tech.
So Maria, what first got you interested in STEM or STEAM?
As a young person, like when I was a kid, I was really into trying to code, but without understanding what coding was, just because it was like glamorized on the media. I was like, I want to break into the matrix. But then as I went on, I actually dropped out of maths when I was 16 because I went to school in France and you're allowed to leave early. And I went into literature, but then I went into the arts. And when I went back into the arts at university, I basically discovered that you could merge art and tech together. And that was my segue into getting into tech, because that was what I knew best and the easiest way for me to get introduced to it. So it was really at university that I started doing it like for reals.
That's so cool. I mean, we ask this question all the time, right? We start almost every episode with this. And I'm feeling like you're someone who got in there early. Like you saw the future. You already knew. You're like, yeah, arts and tech. My uni's doing it. Everyone's doing it. This is the way things are going to be. Is this what you're doing now as a creative designer? Is that what you always thought you were going to do then? Is that something that you've always been like, yeah, this is definitely what I'm going to do. This is definitely what I'm going to end up doing.
Not really, because I had never been good at maths, STEM in general. I didn't get the support that I needed at school, and I'm naturally not very good at it. And so a lot of the times, you know, with the teachers, like they made me feel that I wasn't adequate. Discovering creative tech was also something that I've done almost outside of my degree, because this wasn't taught actually in my degree. I discovered it randomly by going past a makerspace in the university. And I would say that I've always wanted to be related to digital in some way or another, but I couldn't really envision it because it wasn't around me at the time. It was really at university when I realized that, you know, I started learning Python in first year just because I finally found a website that made sense to me. And I realized that I wrote this stuff about the Milgram experiment. I made it as a book, and then I made my first text-based video game based on that book. And I was like, oh my God, this works. This can be done together. But even then at the time, I couldn't see it as a career. I couldn't see it as something that I could do sustainably as an adult. It still felt like a pipe dream, a bit of a fantasy for fun. It felt like a hobby. That's how it felt like. It felt like a hobby. So I would say that university is when I consolidated those two together in a serious way.
Yeah, I mean, because that's so cool. I didn't even know, but I don't know what a creative technologist is. I didn't even know that was an option. What do you actually do in a day-to-day?
This is a loaded question, because I do not have like one set job. I have multiple jobs. So my day-to-day is a mix of working at Child Rights International Network as a digital designer. That day-to-day is working with the issues that my team is working on, like children's rights issues, and bringing that into the public through social media and our website. And I do a bit of like web development, like a bit of HTML, a bit of CSS here and there. But then on Mondays and Fridays, I work at Ricebox Studio, which is a creative tech company that uses creative tech and design for social good. And that's a company that I co-founded with three of my friends. So we basically use a mix of AR, mainly augmented reality is what we use as a form of emerging technology to do our projects. But a lot of the day-to-day is like overseeing the admin, staying in touch with clients, and I'm the creative and tech producer over there. I also teach. So sometimes I teach in BA graphics at Sheffield Hallam University, where I introduce concepts of creative technology and activism. So it's a creative technology is basically merging the arts with a form of technology. Often it's emerging. So it could be, for example, creating a visual website that uses a form of interaction that's interactive to display a certain topic, or for example, using AI as a way to embed in the creative projects for, I don't know, body recognition and facial recognition, or using augmented reality and virtual reality as a way to create like a space, a world, a digital world as part of your project. So it's quite a vague term. It's still evolving. It's literally intersection of art and technology.
I want to be Maria.
Yeah, it sounds like such a cool life. And so nice to hear about tech being used for like social good, that creative outreach is really cool. And I want to pick up on what you were kind of talking about AR, because that leads really nicely into our first big what. What is AR? And also another kind of buzzword that I think a lot of people will be aware of with art and tech is, what are NFTs? I know they're quite different, so tackle that as you like.
So augmented reality, also known as AR, is where you merge digital objects and things into the real world. So an example of AR, the one that we know the most, augmented reality filters on Instagram, Facebook, and Snapchat. That is hands down one of the most democratic uses of it. But another example of it is in gaming. So Pokemon Go, one of the most famous mobile-based games that came out in 2016. It took the world by a storm, and it really shows you the impact that AR can have on people. But AR is more than games and filters. A lot of people put them in those categories. It can also be used in marketing and advertisement. It can be used in education. And so, for example, IKEA used it in their catalog as a way for people during COVID to see furniture in their rooms. Or in Superdrug, you can use it to see makeup on yourself so that you don't have to use all the different, you know, eyeshadows and testers that have like bacteria on them. So NFTs, I'm going to be using Erin Griffith's definition from the New York Times, because it's a great definition. So an NFT is a non-fungible token. So a non-fungible token is basically a digital token that represents the authentic, limited version of a piece of digital media. So for example, a GIF, an MP3, a JPEG, a video. Non-fungible means that the token is unique and cannot be replaced by something else or cannot be modified. Right. So it's like this thing that's like permanent, this digital object that's permanent and can't be tampered with. So an NFT, think of it as like a certificate of authenticity. Like imagine if you buy like a handbag from Louis Vuitton or something, it comes with a receipt, right? It comes with a certificate of authenticity saying this bag is unique. This bag has a serial number. This bag is owned by the company. It's legit. So that certificate represents the authenticity of the bag. The same way an NFT represents the authenticity of a digital object. So it's like the receipt of a JPEG. If I make a digital drawing and I sell it as an NFT, I'm selling the certificate of the JPEG itself. It represents the uniqueness of my image or whatever digital tool that it is. So a lot of people say, but can you just screenshot an NFT? Like, can I just screenshot it and I've got it? That's not how it works. So the digital art itself is not an NFT. The NFT is the vessel of the art. These are two different things. It's very important that we understand the difference. So when we talk about NFT art, a lot of the times we're actually talking about digital art. The NFT is just a vessel.
Super, super, super clear. Sometimes people can get caught up in the hype and sometimes people hear money and they're like, what, right? Or a lot of folks have got excited about the idea of ownership and all the rest of it. So I think it's great to hear those two definitions. And I think AR, you're right, with augmented reality, we do talk filters. And I wish we did talk a little bit more about the way that this can solve problems for folks, the way that this can help people not get bacteria in their eyes, as well as lots of other things. So, you know, why are these two in particular, before we roll on to the next kind of future topics in the next what, why are these two in particular important? And why are they important for people to understand? Why are they important tools for people to use? And why have they been the ones that have been talked about the most, I guess? Like, why are they the ones that are most prevalent, you'd say, of the future trends?
So the first one on why they are so talked about, because it's the easiest answer. I guess the main reason is what you literally just pointed out, money. What happened was when Beeple, the digital artist, sold his art for like, how much was it? Like 70 million to Christie's in the auction. It created this idea that everybody could make millions of money out of NFTs. So unfortunately, the conversation is very noisy, where there's a lot of misunderstanding of this idea of this emerging technology that a lot of people think is going to make them rich. And we need to dispel that myth immediately. This is like any other tool that you're selling. It's not going to automatically make you rich unless you already have a big platform like Grimes. So that's one thing I want to refute. You're not going to be necessarily rich. Don't go into it for the trend. However, why is it important? So as an artist, the fact that you can authenticate digital artworks using an actual encrypted system that is irrefutable is amazing. Because in the past, when it came to selling digital artwork, as a digital artist, you often had to like print it out, sell it as a physical print in markets. You had to go through galleries, you know, get a curator. There were so many middlemen that would basically get your art sold. But this time, you as a digital artist, you can independently sell this directly to the consumer and access multiple markets and have the ability to sell it in ways that you might not have been able to do beforehand. There's legitimate marketplace now where you can do this. And also some platforms have this thing where if you sell your NFT and it gets sold somewhere else in the blockchain, you can get like royalties. Whereas in the past, if you sold a physical piece of art and it sold somewhere else, you don't get royalties. Or at least you need some kind of system to get the royalties, and it wasn't as prevalent. So here you can, you know, skip that. There's less overhead. And there's some folks in the world that don't have access to museums and galleries. You know, some folks in like rural areas, also in places where you have more barriers, and it removes that barrier. They can sell it in a way that's, like I said, independent, and they can be autonomous in the way they want it to be sold, especially in smaller art and design scenes. And so it's also important because we can't ignore as well the conversation about environment. So NFT uses often uses like cryptocurrencies such as Ethereum and Tezos. And Ethereum, for example, or even Bitcoin, you know, they're not great for the environment. Mining for cryptocurrencies can be pretty detrimental for our world. And that's something we need to talk about, because there's a lot of technologies and monies and really smart people that are looking into making it safer and better for the environment. And that's something that we need to push for. If we're going to be using NFTs, we need to talk about the good and the bad. If we talk about the bad, we got to look for alternatives. It's not about striking it off and say, no NFTs forever. It's about looking at how can we use it and harness it for good. How can we really make this, you know, as a tool to empower people?
I do think you're so right. It's been so clouded by, maybe this is a way we can make a quick buck. I think that idea of ownership is really cool, and giving a way to have actual ownership of your art online is really interesting. I just want to unpack for our listeners kind of what you just mentioned about blockchain and Ethereum, crypto. What is that? For people that don't know, what is the real deal there?
So I'm going to explain quickly what a blockchain is.
A blockchain is a way of recording information in a chronological order over a network of computers.
So literally imagine a chain and there's like little blocks on it. And each block is a piece of information that comes in chronologically. So every time there's new information or some kind of transition done with an NFT, so for example, if I sell an NFT, well, that's going to create a piece of information saying this NFT has been sold, you know, somewhere at this time in place. And so that information is going to be put into a little block. That little piece, that little block of information is then added as a new link onto the chain. Every single block of information has information about like the NFT, every time it's being sold, every time it's being burnt or minted. And then that information is placed in a chronological order. And each block uses encryption technology, which means the data is secured with a private key and it cannot be tampered with or altered. And because it's a decentralized system, meaning the system isn't owned by anyone, that means that no one can actually edit that information. So think of it as an archive, and that archive is chronological, and it's online, and it's database, and most of all, it cannot be edited, modified, or tampered with. Cryptocurrency, I'm going to just say very quickly, it's basically a currency that is purely digital. There is a lot of ins and outs on that one, but I feel like it's easier if I just keep it at that.
I'm loving that we've got this covered. I feel like it's also time for our second big what, although we've had quite a few whats already, Maria, and you've been great. You've been like catching all these whats and throwing them back like, yeah, I got it. You know. We've spoken quite a lot about these future trends and maybe how it's administering the art maybe, or helping the artist rather than it being about how you're creating art and being more on the design side, right? And the innovation side. So I want to flip to kind of the other side and ask you, what is that overlap between tech and art, and how are folks getting to create differently now as a result of maybe these tech trends, but maybe other tech trends?
So first thing that comes to mind, and I am going to preface this and say I'm mainly, you know, a digital artist, less of a traditional artist. Like, I'm not a sculptor. So maybe some of this might not be as relevant, although I think they are. Anyways, first word, boundless. It's allowed, so the development of emerging technologies like AR, AI, VR, and digital spaces in general has allowed for artists and creatives to really push the boundaries of the art, but in a sense that it is boundless. When we look into the concept of metaverse, which I know is in of itself quite debated because the word is like a really general word that refers to any virtual world, the idea that you have a virtual world in which you have a space that you can interact with others, but most of all create, means that now we can create our own digital world and place our vision into a boundless world. So let me give you a physical example of that. A very simple one is The Sims, right? So The Sims has allowed for a lot of young people to create their own universes, either as a means to just have fun, create houses and characters, or even for some more like creatively inclined young people, they used it as a way to really, you know, have fun with interior design and create these little worlds. Same way with Minecraft, you know, a lot of people creating their own little worlds, breaking it up, building it again. So this is more like a basic example. But if you look into VR worlds or like more expanded kinds of worlds like Decentraland, as an artist who, for example, is well-versed with like 3D design, you can take all of these pieces of art that you create and put it in that world. And then you can really basically curate a world that's immersive, that have avatars. You can create your own avatars, make them look the way you want. And these avatars can be an extension of you, you know, or an extension of a character that you have in mind. There's no boundaries. The laws of physics and gravity, you know, sometimes doesn't apply as much in these worlds if you really want to push it that way. So honestly, that plus the fact that these tools are becoming more democratized means that there's more and more artists that have access to tools and softwares that might not have been democratized in the past. So there's so many people around me now that did not necessarily go to university, and they have access to crazy 3D softwares, you know, that allows them to do VFX the same way Marvel does, but they do it from their bedroom. Or for example, I had access to 3D scanning tools on my iPad. They cost me like, what, £5? And I managed to do a whole music video scanning my entire flat with my partner. We did it together, and we then took that world and put it into a video game engine called Unity that was completely for free. And then we animated our whole world inside of that software. So there's less boundaries.
VFX is the visual effects, right? Just for anyone that's not in that. But yeah. I think I love the idea that I think art was already about escape and about creation and about no limits, right? And so actually the tech is allowing folks to do that in a way that maybe others can also experience that in the same way.
I want to come in on the flip side, not as like a downer, but just to hear what you have to think. How do you think, or do you think that tech is also coming in and making artists feel pressured to like make art that's shareable, make art that's like Instagram friendly? Tate did a Yayoi Kusama exhibition, and there were a few articles like, is this sellout just to like be on Instagram and blah, blah, blah. Do you think that increase of tech and how cool it is? Like, I went to a VR exhibition at the RA and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Do you think that excitement around this new technology is kind of adding pressure to artists who might not be using it to then make art which is Instagrammable or like really cool looking.
Oh my God, yes. That is probably the conversation I have the most with people around me every day. So absolutely, there is definitely this pressure as someone who has to use social media as a way to, you know, grow my platform and to get commissions and everything. Oh my God, the pressure, the burnout, the overproductivity, and the fact that all of these tools, I mean, the whole point of automation is that you basically have the ability to produce things in a quicker way. Right? It's quicker, it's automated, it's more convenient. So with tools that kind of makes it easier to produce art, or at least, you know, gives you a more straightforward pipeline between your art and social media, you do basically feel this pressure of one, there's already so much noise in the digital art realm where you have a lot of people that are just churning and churning and churning without thinking, without, you know, sitting down and thinking about how their art makes sense. They're just churning for the clout. They're just churning in order to get the likes, right? And that's filling up and you're seeing that happen. And then you get stress. You're like, maybe I should be creating as much. Maybe I should also put it out there in order to get the likes and to get the attention and in order to be able to make money. And then you start basically reconsidering your own process as a digital artist. You know, the reason why there's so much of a push to be put on social media is because today that's where all the brands are. That's where people see you, right? That's where people find you in order to get commissions. So it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, you don't have a choice and you kind of have to use it. On the other hand, it does get you as well the attention that sometimes you need, but that's not the case for everyone. So for example, artists that are not necessarily digital, so artists that don't necessarily use, you know, forms of creative technology, there is definitely a push for them to integrate it more because it is a trend. But one thing that I really appreciate with artists that are more analog, they keep in account this traditional way of making where it's pretty much really about the human touch, and really focusing on how things take time. And it's really this aspect of curation and really put time into the craft and really take time into developing that. Whereas in a digital world, because these tools are more automated, we tend to spend less time on the craft. And that's a very important idea. We need to spend time on the craft the same way analog artists have spent time on their craft. It's the same idea, just different. And we tend to fall into that trap of making things really quickly out of convenience. And it's a human thing. It's completely human. It's normal to do that, but we need to fight that. We need to go against that and really see how can we push the tool beyond how it already is, even though it already looks so perfect. For example, AI generation, you know, AI generated images, everyone's using like DALL-E and stuff, and everyone's stopping at the generation of the object. You can't stop there. You got to push it further. As an artist, now that you have a tool that can generate art so quickly, how can you then take it back into your process and push that even further? Push the boundaries of the tool, because the tool has already pushed your own boundary. It's time for you to go back into that human computer interaction and do it even more.
I've got friends who like really into those like AI generation things. And so many of them come to me and be like, art is over. There's no art because now computers can do it. But it is like about evolving that art process. I think that's what really interesting is, like, no, artists still have a place.
100%. To add on to that, if somebody says, oh no, the role of the artist and the creative is dead, you know, what you got to tell them, no, it's just that we've refocused our skills. There's been a pivot. Now it all goes back to the original skill of a creative, which is our ability to come up with a strong, creative, unique, imaginative, visual thought. That is now, it's all boiled down to the most bare bones idea of a creative. So it's just shifted. It's just different now.
I want to drop one more word in before we go to our next big what. And are you ready to kind of, you ready for the weight of this one? Metaverse. What do you feel is going to be the impact? So we've spoken a little bit about artists developing their craft, not developing their craft. You know, we've spoken about people being able to be creative in a different way, in a different space. You know, do you feel like that's impacting the number of artists that we might have, or the demand on artists, or, you know, even the way that people are able to digitally enjoy art? You know, we've spoken about quite a lot of different things actually here, but what's your take?
So I guess my take on the metaverse is it's similar to the NFT talk, which is I feel like there's a lot of noise and the discussion has currently moved and shifted into the public space, which is a good thing. But at the same time, because there's a lot of noise and confusion and frustration and also a lot of over-sensationalization. I feel that, first of all, the conversation, it needs to relax a bit. You know, just we need to listen to each other a bit more on that. Second of all, I feel like when it comes to the metaverse, there is this difficulty of, I feel like it's kind of stuck in a bit of a silo, in a sense of there's a lot of, you know, people in my industry, creative tech or just creative, we're all talking about metaverse, but when it comes to general audiences, they're not really involved in this yet. And I feel like there's a push by tech companies to try and get the public involved, but without trying to explain its potential and what it actually is, aside from this is a space where you can talk. Not to mention, not everybody has the digital tools to access the metaverse. Not everybody has a laptop, you know, and until the metaverse becomes more accessible through phones, for example, and until we address the digital divide, the metaverse isn't going to become this huge thing that we want it to be until it's truly democratized. Another thing is, obviously, it's owned by really big companies and there's a monopoly, when really it's better if it's a bit more decentralized so that we can feel a bit more safe in those spaces. However, that's not the case yet. That's in the future. For now, there is definitely a demand in technical artists and digital artists for the metaverse. Like, I would say that around me, there's more and more job openings for like AR artists, product designers, VR artists, technical artists in 3D, 3D motion designers, often hired by the tech company because they don't necessarily have those roles already within a company, because this is more on the creative side, right? So the creative side is curated much more within those job roles in those tech companies because they need them. They need that vision. Also because it's an emerging technology that's being used a lot in like marketing as well. And there's still a lot of like research and development done in the potential of these job roles in expanding the metaverse and the metaverse itself. So there is a lot of people hiring in those regards, in those areas, but at the same time, still kind of finding their footing in where we stand within the tech world.
It all sounds super exciting. And I think really good that we're kind of bringing the arts into that kind of tech world. I'm going to move us on to our third what, which is kind of about another big thing we're seeing everywhere in tech, and that's AI. So what is AI?
AI is an automated system that appears intelligent to a person who is using it, hence the word intelligence. And often when we talk about AI, we are referring to AI algorithms, specifically machine learning algorithms or deep learning. What is an algorithm? An algorithm is a piece of code which makes the system appear intelligent, and machine learning is the ability for the AI to become more efficient by analyzing data for software. So AI, like forms of AI that we have today, speech recognition, gesture recognition, recommender systems like ads online and stuff, image recognition as well, facial recognition, classification, also natural language processing, which is what allows for speech recognition. So it analyzes and processes human speech to perform a task. So like AI is like everywhere. It's everywhere.
You almost know what's coming next, Maria. AI and art. We should have called this the future of art plus everything. So you've mentioned DALL-E, which I feel like we should definitely unpick what that is and where that fits in. But also, yeah, if we're talking about something, doing something intelligently by an algorithm, then what is intelligent art? Like, how do you even decide what that is, right? Talk to me, Maria.
The concept of intelligence is in of itself, it's a social concept, right? Not as much as a technical concept. Like intelligence, when it comes to intelligent art, I guess that also depends on, is it the eye of the beholder? Like, I guess it depends on the user, how you've set up your standards of intelligence in the first place. It depends on the standards that you've set for the art to become intelligent. So what I mean by that is, for example, so DALL-E, what is DALL-E? DALL-E is this absolutely amazing no-code AI generator that allows you to generate images based on prompts. A prompt is literally a set of words. This is developed by the company OpenAI. The way it works is you write in a prompt. For example, I write in, I don't know, Asian woman wearing VR headset in the style of Renaissance painting. And then what happens is you wait a few seconds and then DALL-E will then give you 4, 5, 6 images that represents an Asian woman wearing a VR headset in the style of a Renaissance painting. And what was incredible was that the outcomes generated, these are all made by a machine, by the way. All of these pieces of art are made by a machine. When they unveiled it and they showed us, you know, how it worked in a demo, everybody lost their minds because of how realistic the outputs are. Dali was trained on images from captions. What is fantastic about that is that now a lot of artists are implementing it into their work. So when it comes to intelligent art, I guess DALL-E is a great example, because this is where a lot of people started saying, oh my God, we're going to lose our jobs, you know, as creatives, because we have a machine that can generate art so realistically now. And, you know, our tutors at university always told us that. They always told us you always, always have to make sure your idea is unique, because one day machines are going to take over. And if your idea isn't unique anymore, you know, you're going to lose. And the thing we got to understand is that DALL-E is excellent, but on more of a technical level in idea generation. In the end, you know, not only is this only 2D and digital art, these are things that basically stop at the generation. You can still take it and make it better. It seems intelligent because it can reproduce so many styles. You can literally make DALL-E create art in the style of like Da Vinci. It's the way that we also understand art. The fact that visually it looks so striking is mind-blowing, but we have to go beyond that. This is a machine created by humans. This is not some magical tool. We need to ground it back into what it is. It's a tool created by humans that was trained on images made by other artists. This is not magic. This is something that you can use just like any other tool. One of the biggest limitations is definitely, like, obviously a lot of people have been talking about bias in AI, but specifically the bias in the dataset, the way datasets are made. The dataset is extremely important because this is what the AI is trained on. So for example, if you have an application of AI within the workplace to filter CVs, or if you have AI that's used for facial recognition by a government, it's extremely dangerous if the dataset isn't curated properly and overseen properly by, for example, people of color. You have some existing forms of AI that have been implemented into different societies. And those AIs, for example, the facial recognition that is used by the London Met, had loads of flaws when it came to recognizing people of color, because unfortunately the data, like the data set on which it was trained, did not include enough, I don't know if it was enough images, or the data set was flawed. And it was done in such a way that when it came to recognizing people of color, it had like a huge percentage of mistakes. And this is very dangerous, because if this is used by an actual authority, then the authority, you know, gives, they have their own systems where they will take those recognitions and they'll do something about it. So for example, if you have someone that is misidentified in a facial recognition tool because the data set doesn't have enough faces by, like, for example, Asian people, Black people, Brown people, that means that the tool might misrecognize you. And if it misrecognizes you, you might get stopped and searched for no reason. And you can be absolutely traumatized by that. Another problem is, for example, in the US, they used AI as a risk assessment tool for people in prison. Again, same problem. This was created by engineers that were mostly male, that were mostly white as well. And also the data set was curated in such a way that the biases of the engineers came into the data set, which meant that these biases affected how the tool was used. So for example, someone who was white or someone who is Black or Asian, you know, it affected them differently in the way it would estimate the likelihood of someone that would reoffend. And so that meant that the judge in the US then factors that score into a set of factors, and they can then determine the type of rehabilitation services that a defendant should receive and whether or not they should be held in jail before trial and how severe the sentence should be. And that's terrible. There's a fantastic book by Sophia Noble called Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism, and basically how Google search engine represented certain groups in a way that was absolutely horrible. So these are issues that are still prevalent, and there's so many activists, artists, creatives, researchers, policymakers that are looking into this, that are trying to make this better. The main thing I guess we got to do is we got to open up the black box, make sure we all understand how AI is used, its potential for harm in order to improve lives, right? So this is a huge topic for me. Like, it's so important. It's so important.
I know. And we've only got however many minutes on the podcast. We could talk about this forever. I mean, I have lots of these examples in my book because there's so many of them. Like, it's happening so often. You know, one of my favorite examples is there's a big TikToker called Elaine Baby who does kind of welcome to like areas in the UK, and they're absolutely hilarious. But, you know, she went to renew her passport photo and it thought she had a medical condition because her top lip is a lot darker than her bottom lip because she's a black woman. And I think it's definitely one where the more folks that are thinking about this, the more folks that are aware of this, the more folks that are using the right kind of tools. I'm a trustee at the Institute for the Future of Work as well. And we're looking at Algorithmic Accountability Act, like trying to bring something to government where it's like, look, you know, in the same way that when you talk about data and GDPR, you have a data controller and you have a data owner, how do we have, you know, the person that created the algorithm and the person that's deploying it being held accountable for what happens as a result of it? But, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. We cannot end the series on a low. So let's end it on a high with our final what. Let's squeeze it in there just before time is up. You know, in what ways are AIs being made inclusive?
Okay, I'm going to name a bunch of people and the stuff they've done because it's amazing. So I've got Feminist Internet, a collective of designers, academics, activists, and they aim to disrupt inequalities in internet products and services by educating and equipping people who build them and use them. So they bring together tech, intersectional feminism, and creative practice to make tools that provide real solutions. So one of the things they've created is, I'll know how to pronounce this. I'm very sorry, Feminist Internet, but they created an AI-powered chatbot called FXA, FXA, and that AI-powered chatbot teaches people about AI bias and makes suggestions on way the impact of bias occurring in AI systems can be limited. So this was created in collaboration with Kamuzi. I actually know them both, like the co-founders. Kamuzi, and it's... this tool is very meta, by the way. So it's an AI tool that is about AI bias. It's a chatbot. Definitely check it out. They also created another bot called SIB. So it's a prototype voice interface connecting trans and non-binary people to media created by their community. So the project was developed through a participatory design process with a team of trans and non-binary people. And it created also an open call for a course at the University of the Arts London. There's also the Hip Hop Poetry Bot by Alex Fafiga, who is the co-founder of Kamuzi. So this is so cool. It's an AI research project that looks at speech generation that's trained on rap and hip hop lyrics by Black artists. So the Hip Hop Poetry Bot uses AI to explore the wealth of all this material. So rap and hip hop works done by Black artists throughout history. And the research project is built on an algorithm that's trained on a data set of lyrics. And so they're currently doing an open call and asking different rap and hip hop artists to contribute their lyrics to the data set, to create this public data set of predominantly Black artists to train it on. So that's so cool. There's also the community AI meets design. That's my last example, don't worry. So AI meets design is this amazing community that is founded by the researcher and designer Nadia Piet. I'm very sorry, Nadia, if I'm destroying your last name. And they basically do a bunch of online events and talks, and they also create all these toolkits and public resources to make it easier to use AI in the shared pursuit of creativity, justice, and joy. All of us here today, we can join that community. It's online. You can look at their resources. They've got these kind of card game for designers that kind of looks at like speculative scenarios of AI and how to implement it within your project. They also have something called an AI playground that spotlights creators from around the world that uses AI for their practice. They got something called the AI Design Lab. It's a space to test and experiment with AI. And they also look at everyday data hacktivism. It's a research project that explores everyday acts of tech subterfuge. I love that word. And looking at data rights as well. So those are like the big people. There's a lot. There's fantastic work being done.
I feel a little bit more ready for the future. And I know listeners will definitely be more ready for the future. We've pat their heads forward so much, Maria, but I know there's much, 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 much more where that came from. Where can our listeners find out more about you and the work you do and follow you?
Oh, yeah. So you can find me on Instagram at Blurb Nation. Don't ask me why it's called that. It's a long story. BLURBNATION. And also Ricebox Studio on Instagram. That is where the studio that I co-founded is. I also got a website, but you know what? Just use my Instagram. Everything is there. I've got a link tree. I got all my links in there. So it should be cool.
You have been listening to Stemets Say What? A podcast brought to you by Stemets. To find out more about Stemets, visit stemets.org. That's STEMETTES.org. Or you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok via the handle Stemets.
And don't forget to subscribe to the show, of course, so you'll get the latest episode as soon as it's released. And while you're there, why not leave a review and let us know what you thought? I've been Carla Rosario.
And I'm Amri Emafidon. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by Unedited.